Okay, so we come to our second lecture on Eliot's The Wasteland. We discovered last week quite a few things, so I'm going to recap a little bit on what we did last week. I want to particularly think of The Wasteland as a poem of allusion, by which I mean to examine its very embedded intertextuality, the fact that at virtually every juncture in the poem, virtually every point you might look at, there is going to be a reference to what we might call a precursor text, you know, another text which Eliot is using in order to illuminate his own vision. So it's very much a poem of allusion, I think, and we want to try to examine why it is or what the effect is, rather, of those allusions. I'll say a little bit more about the structure and do a little bit of close reading of one or two passages just to illuminate some of those ideas. Okay. So last week, I think, these are the kinds of things that we covered. We looked particularly at the sources, and particularly myth and romance, Eliot's debt to Jesse Weston's book From Ritual to Romance, which is very popular at the time, and James Frazer's The Golden Bough, this sort of huge overview of world belief, religions, mythology, which acted as a source text for Eliot. The fact that European literature in general is important throughout The Wasteland, references going all the way back to medieval times, people like Dante, but always also forward. There are Renaissance references, there are 18th century references, there are 19th century references. So ranging over the whole breadth of European literature, this very broad range of reference, you have to take on trust, I think, that very broad range of reference is going to be intentional, that Eliot intends an effect when he deliberately juxtaposes some old reference with his text, as it were. Some perhaps unintentional. The figure of Marie in the opening section is maybe some half-remembered thing that he picked up, but nonetheless, I think it's very clear that you have a text which draws upon very, very wide reading, very, very wide range of knowledge, and incorporates that within Eliot's text. So what that means, really, I suppose, is it's a perfect example in Bakhtin's terms. Bakhtin, of course, the critic who invented, well, not invented, but who developed the idea of the dialogic text. He's, in his terms, I think The Wasteland is very much one of those sorts of texts. It carries on a continual dialogue with other works of literature and other authors. It's informed by and informs those other works. And I think that's something that Eliot himself mentioned in some of his work. So there's a line in his essay, very influential essay called Tradition and the Individual Talent, where he said, "The past should be altered by the present as much as the present is directed by the past." And I just want to just examine that a little bit, because the present is directed by the past is a fairly uncontroversial thing to say, isn't it? It's the kind of thing that historians always say. You know, we learn lessons from history. It's knowledge of what's happened before that enables us, you know, to predict or not to make mistakes or whatever in the future. But the first part of that sentence, "the past should be altered by the present," sounds kind of impossible unless you've got a time machine. But I think what Eliot's hinting at there is our concept of the past. that is going to be informed by our current circumstances. So one of the things that we discovered last week was this sense of yearning for a golden age, that sense of nostalgia, if you like, but nonetheless a nostalgia which is tinged by, influenced by our knowledge of what that past was actually like. And so when you think about that idea of a golden age, it is in itself a kind of construct, isn't it? It's not real. So we are constantly adjusting our view of what the past was like based on what we know now. So that idea, I think, that interpenetration of past and present is going to be a theme that we might uncover and examine as we go through the text. I didn't mention this last week, and I should have done, really, because that was the that was the title of the lecture, actually. He do the police in different voices. This was Eliot's first title for The Wasteland. And what it illustrates, I think, is that idea of multivocality, that idea of the voices which reverberate through the poem. As you might expect, it's a quotation. He's lifted it from somewhere else. He's lifted it from Dickens, Our Mutual Friend. And in Dickens's Our Mutual Friend, one of the characters, Betty Higden, is praising her friend who, you know, with a typical Dickensian name, is called Sloppy. And Sloppy's major achievement in life seems to be that he can read out the police reports from the newspaper of you know, horrible crimes and things like that for the entertainment of people around. These are the police reports in the paper. But he does it in this animated way, and he does the voices. So he do the police in different voices. And it's a very small example, I think, but of the way in which Eliot is prepared to take up references from all over the place, in this case, a 19th century novelist. As I say, he was going to use this as the title of the poem until Ezra Pound got his hands on it and decided that wasn't a good title. So we could be studying He Do the Police rather than The Wasteland. But it does illustrate, I think, that idea of the multifaceted nature of the novel, this idea of many voices coming together. Remember that image of the kind of disembodied voices in the fog, of the London fog coming towards you. It's a bit like that. Okay, so moving on then. If we've established that the poem depends on allusion, that its impact is largely a result of that weight of allusion, then we need to unpack that a little bit. The first thing to say, I think, is the density. We've said a couple of times that it's a kind of collage, that you get these references picked from all over the place, from right across, as we said, European literature and culture, and then slotted into particular places in the Eliot text, and what it makes for is a heavy meal, if you like. There's a density of reference in there. And what about the effect of that? And I would say that the effect of intertextuality is at least twofold, in that it imports the connotations that the original text has. So if you're going to make a direct reference to, you know, a particularly gruesome scene in Renaissance drama, for example, then you're importing all the emotions and all the ideas that are connected with that. And you're implying perhaps some sort of comparison with the present circumstance that your text, Eliot's text, is describing. So you've got these two things going on, at least two things I would suggest going on at once. You've got all the ideas and connotations of the original text, and then that develops something in juxtaposition with your text. So, for example, let's take, "But at my back I always hear." In the original text, the Marvell text to his coy mistress, it's a fairly gruesome image because the speaker's talking about the imminence of death, but it's in a fairly joyous context, if you like, or depending on your point of view, maybe rather desperate context. The speaker's trying to get the woman into bed, and his argument, which is, strikes me as not a particularly great argument, is, we ought to have sex immediately because tomorrow we might be dead. As a chat-up line, I don't think this is really getting him very far. So there is that kind of comic element to the Marvell. In the Eliot poem, it's much more downbeat, and what he does is import all those ideas about the imminence of death and the surrounding culture of death. And so it bounces off the Marvell, if you like, and gives it a new resonance in the new situation. And I think that's the technique all the way through The Wasteland, really. So, a couple of examples. We start The Wasteland with April is the cruelest month, and we mentioned briefly last week how that could be compared with all kinds of poems, the most obvious one being Chaucer's prologue to the Canterbury Tales, because that famously starts with Juan that April with his shoulders suta, that idea of April being the giver of life, and this is negating that. So it's a shock that negation of something which is kind of accepted as the image that goes with April. Later on in the poem, Eliot repeats Spenser's line, "Sweet Thames, run softly till I hear my song." And the idea of the sweet Thames, again, life-giving, again, something which is very positive in Spenser's depiction, but in Eliot's poem, juxtaposed with some rather disturbing images of present-day London. And we'll examine those two in a minute. Eliot's view on this, I think, is clear. He talks about art should have interpenetration and metamorphosis. By interpenetration, I take it he means the interaction of text, so that his text will exist in relation to those other texts. And there will be some sort of interpenetration between them. Metamorphosis, changing things, and of course, one of Eliot's core texts, if you like, in The Wasteland is of its metamorphoses. So that's kind of doubly relevant there, I think. So that seems to be Eliot's stance. What I want to do now is to say a little bit about the opening section and the opening of the fire sermon, the third section, to say a little bit about this business of intertextuality. Okay. So if we think about April, we might think about spring, we might think about all of those rituals that we associate with spring, it's to do with fertility, it's to do with growth, it's to do with renewal, all of those things are very clearly associated with the month of April, and it's got many, many references in literature and art to underscore that particular feeling. So a lot of people would say, well, if you're going to start a longish narrative poem with an evocation of April, then you're deliberately drawing attention to Chaucer's prologue. And I think that's probably right. I mean, it seems difficult to imagine that Eliot is going to start with this description of April in these very negative terms, unless he's got in mind at some somewhere in the back of his mind at least, a contrast with Chaucer's Evocation of April at the beginning of the prologue. And also, I think, if you talk about April and spring and so on, you're by extension obviously referring to other celebrations of growth and life, aren't you? So it's an interesting tactic, if you like, at the beginning of the poem to start with the idea of spring, the idea of April, and then negate all of that. So, you know, you were immediately kind of wrong-footing the reader by doing that. There's Chaucer's general prologue, the first 18 lines, which, you know, I don't propose to read to you in Middle English, even though, you know, Middle English was actually the common speech when I was a boy. But what it does do, I think, is indicate, it draws, it's a very interesting text, I think, for our purposes, because it is the kind of, the place that you would go to if you wanted an example of that kind of celebration of life. And Chaucer starts, "When that April with a sure suta, his sweet showers, the drought of March hath pierced to the rooter," so it's all about the rains bringing life. "Bathed every vine in such liquor, of which virtue engendered is the flower." So the flowers are going to grow because of the April rain. He goes on to talk about the sweet winds inspiring the tender crops, the young sun, the small fowls making melody, so the birds are singing. What happens at this time of year then, this stirring of life, this stirring of renewal? "Van longen folk to goon on pilgrimages." They want to go on pilgrimages, so they want to express their thankfulness, their gratitude for the life that has been given to them. People generally go on pilgrimages. Palmers are people who have been to the Holy Land and have therefore got a palm, you know, as a kind of souvenir from the Holy Land. So they've been on a long pilgrimage. So palmers to seek stronges, to go to you know, far off places. But particularly then, from every shire as ender of Ingolunda to Canterbury they wender, the holy blissful martyr for to seeker. So they're coming to Canterbury to give their thanks and to worship at the shrine of Thomas à Becket, in fact, in Canterbury. So, I mean, clearly, I think, in the beginning of The Wasteland, there is no direct evocation of Chaucer. The speaker at the beginning of The Wasteland doesn't say something like, "Oh, well, you know, as Chaucer said." But nonetheless, I think if you're going to start a poem in the 20th century, aimed at a very educated audience, which this was clearly the case here, then they're going to think, at least on some level, about Chaucer's prologue. So that's established there. That idea of worship for life, sense of renewal, and you know, a sense of religion playing a big part in people's lives. There's another poem which is much closer in time to Eliot's The Wasteland, which might also have some influence on him. And this is Rupert Brooke's The Old Vicarage at Grantchester. This was Brooke's family home. Rupert Brooke, of course, was the... well, I suppose you could classify him as a war poet. He didn't really see active service, and he died of illness in Turkey before he'd actually seen much action. But nonetheless, an important poet of the time, traditional sort of poet. And Brooke is writing again, a kind of sense of nostalgia and a sense of longing for home. Remember those lines from Tristan and Isolde that Eliot uses, Frischweg der Winde, Heimat zu, you know, it's talking about longing for the homeland. And this is the same kind of feeling. And this is definitely a poem that Eliot will have known. It's, as you can see, written in May 1912. And it's Brooke thinking about his home, the old vicarage, Grantchester, which is now owned by Geoffrey Archer, rather appallingly. So this is what he says. It's not April, it's May, but he's thinking about springtime. Just now the lilac is in bloom all before my little room. And in my flower beds, I think, smile the carnation and the pink. And down the borders, well I know, the poppy and the pansy blow. Oh, there are chestnuts summer through beside the river, make for you a tunnel of green gloom and sleep deeply above. And green and deep, the stream mysterious glides beneath, green as a dream and deep as death. I'm just going to stop it there. And there's another little passage that I want to share with you in a minute. But interestingly then, if you go back to that first bit, that sounds very kind of celebratory, doesn't it? This is all about spring being positive, good thing, the flowers are blooming, everything looks lovely. But then there's this kind of element of something a little dark, something a little subdued, a little sinister, a little mysterious maybe. The river makes a tunnel of green gloom, which is vaguely reminiscent of the beginning of the fire sermon. The river's tent is broken, Eliot writes. And this idea of something mysterious about the stream and that it's deep as death. You know, so we've moved from the celebration of life to a reference to death very quickly. So here's a poem which on the face of it seems like a very kind of straightforward, oh, isn't it great that it's spring again, to something which is actually a bit more complex. And maybe that's something that Eliot picked up on. Remember the poem is called Café des Westen, so he's in Berlin, and thinking about how his homeland looks. And so his musing gets interrupted at this point. So he's thinking about the day being young and sweet. He's thinking about sort of splashing around in the river and so on. And then, du lieber Gott. Yeah, good God. Here I am, sweating, sick and hot. And there the shadows, waters fresh, lean up to embrace the naked flesh. Temperamentvoll. German Jews drink beer around, and there the dews are soft beneath a morn of gold. So contrasting the urban scene, slightly anti-Semitic feel to that line, perhaps. Contrasting the urban scene where he is now, in Germany, with the idyllic rural scene that he thinks of back in Grantchester. And I think, you know, what this suggests about his poem, and you could also apply this to Eliot's poem, is that ideas of beauty and the promise of spring can be evoked by those simple references that we're all used to, and they're sort of something that we recognise immediately, don't we, as symbolic. You know, the idea of growth, flowers, etc., indicates life, indicates renewal, all those kinds of things. But embedded within that, those rather mysterious lines, notions of doubt, notions of frustration, notions of decay. So if Eliot was thinking about that poem as well as the Chaucer poem, you know, it indicates perhaps how he can import some of these ideas into his poem, and how also round about the time, you know, this is 10 years before The Wasteland is published, but round about the time he's writing, you know, he's not the first writer to think about that contrast between the rural and the urban, which in itself is not a particularly new idea, but one which is being obviously renewed in Brooke's poem, and something which Eliot will explore as well. So that's, you know, one of the themes I think you find in The Wasteland very clearly is this contrast between an idealised rural world and a very kind of sordid urban world. And that's something we'll look at in a minute with his reference to the Spenser poem, Prothalamion. So are you all right with that so far? Yeah? Do ask any questions if you want as we go along. Okay, so Edmund Spenser, writing at the end of the 16th century, is another prominent intertextual source in Eliot's poem. And the particular source that Eliot uses is Spenser's poem Prothalamion. Here's, I think this is by a Dutch engraver called Visscher, and this is what the Thames will have looked like in Spenser's time. This is obviously before the Great Fire of London, so you've got all these wooden buildings. At the bottom of that image is the south bank of the Thames, Southwark, and then looking across, you've got St Paul's Cathedral, not the Christopher Wren one, obviously the one that was there before the fire. And it all looks very pleasant, doesn't it? You know, these boats are scudding around on the Thames. It all looks, you know, very lovely. We know, don't we, that the reality of London during Spenser's time, end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century, yes, some people were living rather luxurious lives, but the majority of the inhabitants were really leading rather, by our standards, rather sordid lives. You know, there's no sanitation to speak of, there are no sewers, so you wonder what kind of filth is going into the Thames at that point. So when Spenser writes his poem, it's very deliberately being placed within a traditional context, and that traditional context is the pastoral, is pastoral verse. So the Prothalamion writes a poem written before a marriage. So this is a celebration of marriage, and therefore, of course, a celebration of fertility, growth, all of those positive things. And what Spenser does, as he's bound to do, writing within that genre, is to idealise the scene. So he doesn't describe, presumably, the Thames, the vision of the Thames that somebody sitting by the Thames might have seen in 1596. He describes something which is an idealised version. And, you know, a bit like Chaucer does. Chaucer mentions the sweet zephyrs, so does Spenser here. Calm was the day, and through the trembling air, sweet-breathing zephyrs did softly play, a gentle spirit that lightly did delay hot Titan's beams. You know, so it's warm, but not oppressively so. You know, a nice little breeze to take the heat off. Everything's wonderful. The speaker is, there's a kind of personal note there. When I, whom sullen care, through discontent of my long fruitless stay in Prince's Court, an expectation vain of idle hopes, which still do fly away like empty shadows, did afflict my brain, walked forth to ease my pain. So this is the immersion of the speaker into this lovely rural, rustic landscape in order to ease his pain. So that idea of a place of fruitfulness, a place of growth, greenery, all of those things, the opposite, if you like, of a wasteland, that's what the speaker is evoking here. And then we get specific in the next section. Along the shore of silver-streaming Thames, whose rutty bank the witch's river hems, was painted all with variable flowers, a
and all the meads adorned with dainty gems, fit to deck maidens' bowers and crown their paramours against the bridal day, which is not long. So this idea of the flowers coming into bloom to sort of celebrate the idea of the forthcoming marriage, the bridal day, also the kind of sense of artificiality, perhaps. You know, it was painted all with variable flowers, which suggests maybe, you know, it's not entirely natural. But nonetheless, you know, this is the idyllic vision that he's presenting us with, and he finishes with that refrain, "Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song." And that line, "Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song," is the one that Eliot takes up. Now, I think what you have to bear in mind is when Eliot uses that line, just going back to what I was saying before about intertextuality, when Eliot uses that line, he's importing all of this stuff, isn't he? He's importing all of this stuff about the loveliness of the scene, the colours, the flowers, the sense of celebration, it's a wedding, you know, all of those nice things. He's importing all of that simply by using that phrase. And then what you get in Eliot's poem is that the nymphs who inhabit Spenser's verse are transformed in the 20th century into something very different. And this is the scene that that Eliot evokes. So instead of a place which is full of life and colour, this is a place that's empty. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs, the kind of presiding spirits in Spenser's terms over this lovely scene, they're gone. And, you know, that idea of who the nymphs are is kind of nailed in the next line, which is directly lifted from Spenser. There's a curious negative in the next lines. So instead of the flowers and the garlands that the Spenserian nymphs would have had, what characterises this Thameside scene is empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, other testimony of summer nights. Except there's none of that. It's a negative. The river bears no empty bottles, etc. So the things that might characterise it, we might think of as being rather rather kind of ordinary, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, etc. But even they aren't there. You know, it's been swept away. Perhaps they had a storm the night before and it swept everything away. I don't know. So you can imagine then that instead of a celebration of life, which is characterised by garlands of flowers and things like that, we've got this rather sordid waste of a summer night. Bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs. You might wonder why silk handkerchiefs. I'm told, I don't know on whether this is a reliable piece of information, but I'm told that silk handkerchiefs were used as a kind of emergency condom. I kind of see that might work. You might need an elastic band, I don't know. But apparently that was, you know, that in the 1920s that was, because prophylactics, as they were called, were difficult to get hold of. So the nymphs are departed, and their friends, presumably the ones wielding the silk handkerchiefs, the loitering heirs of city directors, departed, have left no addresses. So again, we've got that sense of a lack of connection, you know, this rather kind of loveless encounter on the riverbank surrounded by the detritus of the evening. And then nothing is going to come from that. By the waters of Leman, I sat down and wept. which is a sneaky reference to the biblical phrase, by the waters of Babylon, I sat down and wept. Again, thinking back to a lost homeland again. Leman is the is one word for the lake where Eliot was having his recuperation after his mental breakdown when he was writing The Wasteland. And then, again, the repetition of the Spenserian light. So if we think of that sort of nice, idealised image of Spenser's Thames, Eliot's Thames is more like that. That's a contemporary picture. And you can see Tower Bridge in the background there and barges and working boats there. It all looks a bit dingy. Eliot talks about the oil and tar on the Thames later on in the poem, and this kind of indicates that really. So that section of the poem comes at the beginning of the Fire Sermon, section 3. The Fire Sermon takes its name from Buddhist literature. It's Buddha's sermon against lust. That's the fire that he's talking about. The section starts actually just before the passage that we've just looked at. It starts like this. The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses a brown land unheard. And we get the bit we've just looked at. So this idea of the river's tent is broken. You could think of literal and metaphorical meanings for that. I take it to mean the kind of growth that goes over a river, the trees either side of a river that's covered up in the summer. So that's gone. So again, there's an image of growth being restricted or something being decaying. But tent in some religious senses is used as a place of meeting. So if the river is the source of life and the source of ritual, then the river's tent is broken could also suggest a lack of belief, a lack of formal belief, and would therefore indicate the kind of religious and moral decay that Eliot is so keen on emphasising. So I think what I'm trying to suggest to you is that at virtually every turn, at virtually every line in this poem, you are going to get multiple meanings because Eliot is alluding to something else. And he's importing those meanings from the other text, juxtaposing them with the current situation that he's describing, and creating his effects that way. So the old text kind of sparks something in the new text and vice versa. That interpenetration that Eliot was talking about. And in particular, I suppose, in the Fire Sermon, in the bit that we've just looked at, you've got the sort of idyllic certainties of Spenser, which Spenser knows about. Spenser's deliberately writing in a pastoral tradition. He knows that what he's describing is not real. I don't think there were, sort of shepherdesses dancing around the maypole on the banks of the Thames when he was writing that. But nonetheless, he's writing in that tradition which evokes a certain ideal state. And Eliot is drawing upon that and contrasting it with the sordid 20th century realities to the effect that we've just looked at. One thing which I think, just winding up now, coming back to this idea of structure, you could argue, and people do, that the Wasteland doesn't really have much of a structure, particularly since Pound interfered with it so much. So one of the questions you have to ask yourself, I think, is, you know, is there a kind of organized structure, or is it fragments? These fragments I have shored against my ruins suggests, this is the phrase that the speaker uses towards the end, suggests that, that there is some kind of underlying structure, you know, but it's broken, it's not complete, it's disorganized, but nonetheless, you know, there is something there representing that breakdown of civilization that seems to be at the heart of the poem. And we could say that that idea of a breakdown of structure is echoed in the collage of voices towards the end. The last 10 lines or so of the poem are nearly all direct quotations from other works, apparently random, but you know, suggesting that the kind of collective lamentation of people. One thing I would refer you back to is this idea of the wasteland being organised in a spatial way rather than a linear way. So don't think of it as a narrative with beginning, middle and end. Think of it maybe more as something which jumps from point to point and can refer backwards and forwards within its own structure. But nonetheless, you know, even though that's more complex, it's still a structure rather than you know, a non-structure, if you like. We, I think, now think of The Wasteland as being probably one of the defining poems of the 20th century and certainly one of the defining poems of modernism. Of course, when it was published, well, I suppose, and this is something that's perhaps worth emphasising quite often with our modernist writers. You know, when it was published, I was going to say, you know, it created a kind of sensation. There were lots of reaction, and there was within a very limited circle. But I think if you'd asked, you know, the famous man on the Clapham omnibus what he thought about T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, he'd probably just say, T.S. who? This is being consumed by actually a very small coterie of people, an elite. And it created a lot of debate, and that debate was quite polarised. Some people thinking of it as a work of genius, and some thinking it was just fragments. So here's a later assessment, which is just trying to summarise the impact that that The Wasteland had. This is, you'll see the reference on the slides on Blackboard. This is J.X. Cooper from T.S. Eliot and the Politics of Voice. The reason I picked this one out is because I thought it was quite a nice summation of a certain position. So it's not merely reflecting the breakdown of order. This is kind of picking up the point about the nostalgia for the past. The disaster that characterised modernity was not an overturning, but the culmination of that very order. So in other words, it's not looking back to the past. It's saying, yes, the past was better, but the past was inevitably leading to the disaster that we have now. You know, so the past wasn't particularly good. The past was just a bit better than what we've got now. Cooper goes on to say, the older generation saw the events, like the Great War, as a passing of a golden age. Eliot saw only that the golden age was itself a heap of absurd socio-political axioms and perverse misreadings of the cultural past. So, you know, that idea of a golden age is false, according to Eliot, and that's what he's juxtaposing with the present day when he evokes that golden age. So I just thought that was quite a neat summary of that position. Some contemporary views. Lewis Untermeyer was a well-known critic and writer and poet in America at the time. And he described The Wasteland as Mr. Eliot's poetic variations on a theme of super-refined futility. I don't think he meant it was very good. from that point of view. Although he did have one positive thing to say. He said, although it was a pompous parade of erudition, which doesn't sound very positive, but as an echo of contemporary despair, a picture of dissolution, the wasteland has definite authenticity. So even in a negative review at the time, it's suggesting this idea of presenting modern dissolution and despair and breakdown and saying that you know, it's authentic in that sense. Amy Lowell, who was one of the leading lights of the Imagist Poets group, well, leading light is perhaps too strong a term. She was heavily involved in it. She financed it to some extent. Her response to The Wasteland was succinct. A piece of tripe, she called it. Which seems a little harsh, shall we say. But what it illustrates, I think, is that the poem did divide critics, and some people thought it was a step too far in modernism. You know, this was not the way to go because of its fragmentary nature. Whereas others found that it did evoke the present scene, the idea of a breakdown in civilization, very effectively.